from the Sky News Centre at 5. English football's in mourning following the death of Sir Bobby Robson. He was 76 and had been suffering from cancer. The former striker and manager led England to the semi-finals of the 1990 World Cup. Alan Shearer played under Robson at club and international level and says he was unique.
He was able just to light the place up. He was able to light the dressing room up, and because of his experience and because of the respect that everyone had for him, when he spoke, people listened. And he asked you to do well. You wanted to do well for him because you liked him and you adored him.
The mother of a computer hacker who faces extradition to the States has appealed for Gordon Brown and President Obama to intervene. Gary McKinnon, who admitted breaking into US military computers, lost his latest High Court bid to avoid extradition. He's got Asperger's syndrome. Businesses in Nottingham are voicing their concern at a new workplace parking tax. Any firm with more than 10 staff spaces will be charged £185 a year for each from 2012. The pilot scheme could be rolled out across the rest of the country. A fire station gutted in a blaze overnight wasn't fitted with smoke alarms. The fire station in County Down and two fire appliances were destroyed this morning. In cricket, England are batting on day two of the third Ashes test against Australia. Live to Guy Swindles at Edgbaston.
England 67 for two in their first innings and struggling really to take advantage of the wonderful work by the bowlers earlier today, as Australia, who started on 126 for one, were all out for 263, 5 wickets for James Anderson. Andrew Strauss is still there, but Cook and Bapara both out. For two, Guy Swindles, Edgbaston.
And the space shuttle Endeavour has landed safely in Florida following a 16-day mission. The 7-member crew spent their time updating and maintaining the International Space Station. A Japanese astronaut was amongst those on board. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
FM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Conservative Councillor for Froome Vale at Bristol City Council, Leslie Alexander. And our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. Marina Morris also has been looking very closely again this week at swine flu. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and then moving on in the second half of the show to tease out, if we can, a bit of insight into how Bristol City Council works or doesn't work from Leslie. But before that, here's our two-week Friday drive time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, average temperatures around 17 degrees Celsius, and that's in the daytime. Cloud cover and rain. It will be rainy, more rainy certainly anyway, on Saturday. Sunday looks better with sunny spells. Next week, average around about the same, 17 degrees Celsius, warming up later in the week, and a fair amount of rain. More sunny spells, sounds like more of the same. Next weekend, that's the 8th and 9th of August, a little bit warmer, average of 18 degrees Celsius in the daytime, dry, cloudy, with sunny spells. That sounds a little bit better next weekend, doesn't it? Anyway, it's time for our look to this week's news stories, and I'm joined by a Conservative Bristol City Councillor for Froome Vale, Leslie Alexander. Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
Now, how long have you been a councillor for Bristol City Council?
6 years.
And can you tell us how you got into politics? Where did you come from?
I started with the Young Conservatives when I was about 16. And most of my life I've been a Tory activist for various campaigns, and then when I took early retirement I became a councillor.
So early retirement from what? What were you doing before you became a councillor?
I worked for one of the major banks.
Okay. So as an ex-bank employee yourself, how culpable for today's crisis do you think the banks are?
I think probably some of the very senior management are very culpable, but I think everybody, unfortunately, is bearing the brunt.
Martin Summers is here too, who's our Labour economics expert and political pundit. Martin, tell us about your Oxford PPE background. For those of you who've never heard of PPE, what is PPE?
It's philosophy, politics and economics. It was called Modern Greats. It was set up in 1918, supposedly to educate the political elite away from things like Greek and Latin and doing something more useful like philosophy, politics and economics. So it was the kind of degree that prime ministers used to do. So Labour and Tory prime ministers often ended up doing that degree.
So you think of yourself as a potential prime minister yourself?
I think it's a bit late for that, Tony.
Okay. Now let's have a look at some of this week's news stories. We're going to start off by looking at the Vestas occupation in the Isle of Wight. It's the occupation of a Danish-owned factory which is making wind turbine blades down in the Isle of Wight. To begin with, let's hear from two local people, both of whom have been campaigning in support of the Vestas workers who've taken over the factory on the Isle of Wight rather than just lose their jobs. In a minute, trades union activist Joe Benefield, but first we hear from a group called Bristol Rising Tide, which is trying to reverse climate change.
I'm Trevor Houghton. I'm from Bristol Rising Tide. This is one of the groups that are involved in organising the Welsh Climate Camp over at Merthyr Tydfil, which will be taking place from the 13th to the 16th of August. The camp has been called in that particular place because there is it's one of the places where new open cast coal mining is going on in the UK, which there's many sites, and this is sort of replacing deep mining and is to fuel the new generation of coal-fired power stations that are currently being planned by big power companies with the assistance of our government.
Now, you say on your leaflet here, climate change is the biggest threat our world has ever known. Don't you think that's a bit of an exaggeration? I mean, the threat from nuclear war, and there are other threats which are more dangerous, surely.
Most of those other things we're actually capable of stopping. Climate change, it's really questionable about whether we can stop it.
But they're both matters of government policy, aren't they?
There are matters of government policy, but in terms of what we as ordinary people can do, if we're going to do anything about climate change, we've got to do it now. Otherwise, we will have missed our opportunity to actually stop it having really long-term detrimental effects.
But isn't the problem really that people just want comfortable lifestyles, and if they're going to have comfortable lifestyles, they've got to have climate change?
Well, you can't have the two together, really. You won't have a comfortable lifestyle with climate change. You'll face flooding, you'll face heat waves, you'll face the sort of thing we just had just recently, which is intense rainstorms. All of those things are associated with climate change.
But before the days of climate change, people would just say, oh, the weather's a bit strange this month.
Well, the weather's going to be a bit strange all the time, and it will be of a severity that will affect people's lives and make it really difficult for them to carry on as they're doing at the moment.
That was Trevor Houghton from Bristol Rising Tide. Then I spoke to one of the organisers of today's visit by one of the Vestas wind generator blade workers, who calls himself Hot Pot. He's been down here today, but I spoke to one of the organisers of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Club meeting today at Temple Meads.
My name's Joe Benefield, and I went down to the Vestas plant in the Isle of Wight. I took a message of solidarity from my union branch, which is the Communication Workers Union Southwest Engineering branch. I went with Jerry Hicks, who took solidarity messages from Rolls-Royce test areas and a donation. We went down because we were so inspired by their occupation. You know, what do we need? We need a green world. They are doing, there's 600 people producing turbine blades. We need them. We are inspired by them. The planet needs them. We went down to congratulate them and to support them because we want it to continue. And we want them to have their jobs. We want the plant to stay open, and we want it nationalised.
Can you tell me why you think this, so many people come along today? Why you think this issue has brought so many people together?
Well, it is the issue. This, the Vesta's occupation of their plant on the Isle of Wight has everything. You know, it appeals to people who care about the environment. It appeals to people who are concerned about the jobs. Often, those people have the same concerns anyway. But it has inspired people because it has done something. It's not just words. They have done something. And the word has gone around the world. It is global. They're receiving messages of solidarity from across the world. It's an inspiring act. It's what people want to happen. And people are concerned about their jobs, they're concerned about the climate, and this is a way forward.
Why do you think that the business secretary, Peter Mandelson, hasn't intervened?
I think it's embarrassing. You've got a new Labour Party that is wedded to the idea of market forces and the market rules. Here we have an obvious demonstration of the market failing. Free market, who benefits from that? The bosses, the bankers, and the new Labour government that is tied to it.
Now, you went along to the Vestas meeting, Martin. Can anything be done to save these jobs, or is it all just a waste of time, a lot of hot air?
Well, I think there was quite an interesting cross-section of opinion in the meeting about what was to be done to save the jobs. So some of the more green people there were suggesting things like setting up a workers' cooperative. The problem with that is that the market for the things they're producing is in the United States of America, and there isn't actually a huge market for what they're producing at the moment in Britain.
Well, I've seen lots of wind farms around here. We've got offshore wind farms.
Yeah,
we're being told this is the future.
Well, it is, but the stuff they're producing is very big wind farms, which are to be used off, you know, offshore. I think what's really, really poignant here is all over the world, people are talking about a green industrial revolution as a way to get out of the slump, and yet where we've actually got a functioning green company, they don't seem to be able to make it work, although they are still in fact making a profit in Britain. So of course the workers are very angry about that, because they're a profitable company. There's just more profit to be made by shifting it to the US. So I think the kind of debate we had was obviously more practical about how we can support the people who are opposing this change, but in the long run we need to think about having a green industrial policy, whether it's in Britain or in the US, because without an industrial policy it's very difficult for individual companies to buck the existing market setup.
Let me bring you in on this, Leslie. What are your thoughts about this? Do you think that there should be some efforts made by the government to save this factory?
It seems to me, and perhaps it's a bit, perhaps I'm being naive, but if it's a profitable company in this country, then why can't we have the company here and in the United States? Because there are more and more wind farms going up around the United the shores of the UK. So I would have thought there was room for both.
I mean, what are your thoughts on the market generally? Because, I mean, if the market was to prevail, you'd probably find, because of cheap labour abroad, almost all British industry would be transferred, factories would be closed down, and the stuff would be made abroad. What do you think about that as a principle? Because that seems to be part of what's going on to British industry. Certainly up north, if you go around up north, you'll see loads of empty factories where the work is now being done abroad.
Yes, and I'm not quite sure what the answer to that one is, but we certainly don't want to lose any more of our industry to companies abroad. We've lost too much of it in the past years.
So are you a free marketeer, or do you think the government should intervene? Because it's a difficult one, this, for a lot of Conservatives.
It is a difficult one. I think I'm a free marketeer, but I suppose in the current economic climate, the government perhaps ought to make an investment in some of these companies to stop them going abroad.
Well, as they have done in the banks, for example. Martin, what do you think about the idea of nationalising this? Is this, I mean, because we haven't been nationalising industries for a long, long time in Britain, since the 1940s.
Apart from the banks, of course, which is the big elephant in the room. And I think the government intervention in the banking industry has demonstrated, to my mind, the bankruptcy of the neoliberal policy. I mean, if we were to pursue a coherent neoliberal policy, then you let the banks collapse. And actually, I think that's what we should have done. Strangely enough, as a socialist, I believe that the market should have been allowed to work there. And then, of course, what you do is the government has to provide the services which the banking industry used to provide. What we seem to be doing is giving government money, which is taxpayers' money, our money, to the banks in order that they can remain or seem to remain private. But this is an illusion. They're not actually private. They are actually now government institutions. And if they're government institutions, they should be run in the public interest.
And did you get a sense from this meeting today that there is enough support for these workers on the Isle of Wight, the wind power people,
I think what was clear, and everybody was clear about that, and the chap who spoke, Howard, was very clear about it, that if people don't resist when they're bullied, then they get walked all over. And he gave us lots of instances about how the managers were bullies before all of this, and that people were scared of them. Many of them wanted to join a union but were scared to do so. Now they've found their voice, but it's a bit late.
Well, if we have sustainable green industries, we can't have bullying managers with them.
Well, we've got to have cooperation on both sides of industry. It requires consultation and discussion, which is what happens in other European countries automatically. We'll probably, we need that sort of thing here. And if there's a Conservative government, I hope they will take a constructive attitude to talking to organised workers.
What do you think about that, Leslie?
Yes, a Conservative government would need to talk to workers.
Would it be listening as well?
Yes, it would.
Would you be just talking to them?
It would be listening as well.
Okay, well, that's enough for the Vestas factory. Now let's move on to look at another news story this week. And I'm joined by Marina Morris to talk about... We're going to have a little chat for about 10 minutes or so about swine flu again. Marina. This week you're continuing your investigation of the pandemic H1N1.
Swine flu, yes. I am contrasting the big picture and the tone of the messages presented from world government health officials with the view of the street. The news headlines across the globe continue to express concern regarding swine flu. The World Health Organization has said the swine flu virus has reached 160 countries and could infect 2 billion people, one-third of the global population, within the next 2 years. United States officials have said about half the American population, 160 million people, should be vaccinated against the H1N1 virus. This pregnant women and health workers are the top priority. The United States has 44,000 confirmed cases, about a third of the global total. Russia's chief public health officer has recommended the cancellation of school trip abroad this summer as a precaution against swine flu. It follows the news that 14 Russian children are in hospital in the city of Ekaterinburg after returning from a school trip to Oxford last week. Russia has 28 confirmed cases. Britain has the highest number of recorded cases of H1N1 in Europe, with 11,000 confirmed infections, and is in the fourth place in the world after the United States, Mexico and Australia. The UK's government has said that the number of new swine flu cases of infection this week has increased by 10% compared to this doubling of cases last week. It is thought that the start of the school summer holidays could have cut the spread of the virus, with fewer new cases being reported among children aged 5 to 14. Our investigation continues with the views from the street of Bristol about the swine flu pandemic.
Thanks, Marina. Well, the swine flu story goes on, but are we being properly informed on the dangers of the virus, the origins of the virus, and how safe the remedies are? Tamiflu and the swine flu vaccine are, well, Marina Morris went out on the streets of Bristol, central Bristol, earlier this week to see what you think about the swine flu phenomenon. Should we be very afraid and having every injection the government asks us to, or is it all just hype?
Are you concerned about the swine flu pandemic?
I think it can be serious for some, but hopefully, it's been overly exaggerated and people are panicking. I'm just hoping it will straighten out a bit, because it is a bit of a worry. I am a little bit, because both my children are asthmatic and my husband, so obviously it's something I prefer they didn't get, but but I think people need to calm down just a little bit, because it is, otherwise you'll be too scared to go out.
I think it's completely hyped up by the media, to be honest with you. I've already had it, my partner's had it, my child's had it, various friends of mine have had it, and I just think in general that the media are scaremongering people at the moment, and they should wait till winter when it is likely to mutate and then cause problems.
No, a few people die, but then there's people dying from normal flu all the time anyway, so I don't think it's going to be too much of a problem now.
I don't know. I'd have to be very careful, because I've got other things wrong with me, so I'd have to be very careful. It does worry me at times. I mean, I don't live here. I live up in Herefordshire, and touch wood at the moment, we're quite clear. But it does worry me a bit.
No, I think it's very serious. Yeah, it's said that 1,000 people in Bristol alone are going to die. No, they're going to catch it. Yeah, that's right. 1,000 people, that's a lot of people. More than normal flu, I would say. I wouldn't say concerned, but yeah, it does worry me.
What would you do if you got it?
Well, quite luckily, my former employer gave me some medicine gave me some Tamiflu for the last time. But there was a big flu outbreak, so I've already got the medicine, so if I get flu, then I'll just take the medicine and that'll be fine.
Hopefully I'd be quite sensible, ring the line that's recommended and go by what was told, you know, take the tablets and hopefully get over it pretty quick.
Well, I'd stay at home. I'd have to, because I'm diabetic and I've got a heart problem, so I'd have to do something.
Stay at home, stay in bed, I think, yeah, drink lots of fluids.
Would you take a vaccine?
I would consider it purely because of my kids and my husband, and I think they should as well. So yeah, I think I would.
I'm not sure about vaccines, to be fair.
Do you believe the government is doing enough?
I'm not sure. I've got mixed feelings. I'd like to believe they are, but at the same time there's always a niggle because of things in the past that have gone wrong, or they've told us wrong information. So I've got reservations.
I don't think they're doing enough, apart from scaring the general public, really. And that's all they're doing, really, and that's not particularly useful.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult problem for them to deal with. It's obviously massive, so there seems to be enough for me. I mean, I haven't encountered it, so it's fine.
No, I don't. The government have said that we had Tamiflu available, and it's not available. So, no, I don't think they're doing enough.
Is the media coverage excessive?
Yes, definitely. Especially the last few weeks of the holidays, before the kids broke up, you know, there was so much panic, like talking to mums up the schools, everyone was in a right state. So I think too much, you know, every time you turn the news on, papers, yeah, far too much.
A little bit, but it's the press in Britain, it's always the same, it blows everything out of proportion, so what can you do? I think they've got to highlight the issues as they are at the moment, so yeah, it's fairly important to highlight it, I suppose. It just makes sure that everyone's going to be a bit more careful with what they do, so yeah.
I don't know, they're frightening us to death anyway, aren't they? Propaganda and all this and that, the media's laying it on a bit thick. I mean, the other day on the telly, this man, there was about a football match, and they said everybody was wearing masks, and he went to this football match and he said he didn't see anybody with a mask on. So it makes you think it's all in the media.
I don't think it is excessive at all. To be fair, swine flu comes third or fourth on the news when it comes in, so it's not headline stuff.
Why do you think the UK's infection rate is so high?
The only thing I can think of is with all the travelling, and obviously like everywhere else, like places like this, you're in a big environment, and I don't know, and whether it is the thing with, because I know I've been to other countries, and I'm not saying with Britain we're not clean, because we are, but I think there's a real emphasis on things like that need to be, like going to the toilet, wash your hands, use a hanky, all of that. And when I've been other places, there is a slightly higher standard sometimes. So I don't know. I might be wrong, but I don't know.
It's because we're an unhealthy nation. We drink too much, we smoke too much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're not the healthiest nation out there. We're not as healthy as most kind of continental nations. So yeah, that's why it is. I don't think you're going to change that too easily either. So there you go.
I think because we travel a lot, I think it's that time of year, everybody's going on holiday. So yeah, that's why I think we've got a lot of it.
Do you have any advice?
I've already had it, my partner's had it, my child's had it, My voice is basically treated as any flu, because it's pretty much exactly the same symptoms. There's no point in worrying about it and sitting at home not wanting it, because eventually you're going to get it, it's in the air, so you might as well, people shouldn't be locked down in their houses, because that's just silly, really. So that's my advice, is basically just let yourself have it and get back.
That was people of Bristol speaking to Marina Morris earlier this week. Now, we're joined in the studio this week, as you probably just heard, by Leslie Alexander, who's a Conservative councillor on Bristol City Council. Now, fantastically, she also is on the Health Committee. Now, Leslie, what are your thoughts about what you've just heard from the people out in the city centre there?
I think, for the most part, the people out there are very laid back, and I think that's the way most people are at the moment. We haven't had a huge epidemic at the moment. It's all been very mild. I think the government have done what they should have done in ordering the vaccines, etc. I do think they were a little bit late in setting up the telephone service. I think they could have started that a little bit earlier. But at the moment, there's not a real reason to panic. The ambulance service are looking at all their procedures to make sure that they can cope if we get a real epidemic, and the same with the hospitals. But at the moment, we're getting updates from time to time, but nobody's panicking.
Do you think it's right what some of the people said there, that this actually may be mild at the moment, but when we get into the autumn and the winter, it actually may have a greater effect?
I'm sure it will, but normal flu does the same thing during the winter months, so yes, it's bound to be rather more severe at that time, I think.
Well, what do you think about the efficacy and some of the side effects of Tamiflu? Because we had a big debate on here last week about, in Japan and Korea it's been banned. We also see in the Daily Mail today they're talking about young people actually attempting suicide, because it has these psychological effects, particularly on young people as well. So are you happy that the Tamiflu is the right way to be going, or do you have some doubts about that as well?
Well, there are some doubts about that, and yes, it would be, I think they need to look at that one. The things that I've heard at the moment is that about 10% of the people that take it are suffering from nightmares and also from sickness, and those sort of things need to be looked at. Most things do have some sort of side effects, and you have to weigh up the effects of the side effects
with
the benefits.
You have to think before you take that pill, don't you? Am I going to be just having a bit of a runny nose and not take the pill, or am I going to take the pill and get even more ill?
Yes.
So there's lots of questions still about this. What about your committee? What is it doing, and what expert advice is it getting?
We're not doing an awful lot at the moment. I mean, this has rather it's only really built up over the last few weeks, and the council has rather been, since the local elections, in purdah. And of course, the local elections were a month later, so the committees are only just beginning to start up, and we've only had the first meeting so far of the Health Scrutiny Committee. We did have an update. But that is all we've had so far. So I would hope that we will have a meeting very shortly with the health officer for Bristol, and he will be able to tell us some more.
Well, let's hope if the people really start going down with this and in a big way, that the council gets its finger out.
Well, I think the council, and it's not just the council though, and obviously the main people to get their fingers out, as you put it, are the health service, and they are certainly preparing themselves, and they've got emergency, they're looking at their emergency systems.
Now, one of the things people were saying just now was that that maybe it's because we're actually not very healthy here in Britain, that's one of the reasons why Tamiflu has decided that Britain is one of its most favoured nations.
I suspect it might be more to do with the fact that we're probably one of the most crowded nations, rather than that we're unhealthy, because I don't think we are. I mean, there are pockets of unhealthy neighbourhoods, but for the most part, perhaps some of that needs to be addressed with education, on the right sorts of things to eat, etc.
And of course, that is the sort of thing which is going to get your immune system going. It's going to make your body really prepared for any kind of virus that's coming your way. Martin, can I just have your thoughts on the swine flu and the Tamiflu and the vaccines?
Well, I think what we were saying earlier about the trade-off between taking a vaccine or not taking it, I think if you're basically a healthy person, you're probably better, as that chap was saying, I've had it. I mean, now that was good to hear. He's saying, I've had it, my partner's had it, my children have had it, nothing to be frightened of. And I think that was a good thing to hear. But of course, for the elderly lady saying, well, I've got a few other complications, I'll have to be careful, well, that might be the case for a vaccine. I'm not a doctor and I wouldn't like to pass judgment, but it seems to me that that's the sort of judgment that needs to be made.
I think it's fair to stress that nobody here is a health professional, and much of this stuff is hopefully just common sense. Now, moving on to another story in Bristol, the seagulls should not be punished for eating food they think has been left out for them in bin bags, is the gist of the lead letter from someone called Jay Weaver, who was even mugged by a seagull for his ice cream, apparently, in yesterday's Bristol Evening Post. It was the lead letter. He or she implies that seagulls are doing very well out of the increase in rubbish left around. Now we have these twice-weekly bin collections. So are seagulls really an urban menace, Leslie, as the council would have us believe?
It's twice a month, not twice weekly collections. So yes, there is more food left for the seagulls. There was about 2 years ago, the councillors all gave up their biscuits with their coffee so that we could oil the eggs of the seagulls to stop them breeding, or to stop so many of them breeding.
Does that actually work? Oiling their eggs?
Well, I haven't really noticed that there's a lot less seagulls. I think probably their menace is more to the fact that they can dive bomb you with their mess, which, if you're not careful, lands wherever and on the cars and things.
But it might be fair to say the seagulls were here before the people were in Bristol and around this area, Martin.
Well, no, because seagulls have adapted to our way of life. I mean, they used to live in cliffs. They now live on top of tower blocks, and they're much more successful living on top of tower blocks than they ever were living in cliffs.
So they don't follow the trawlers anymore, then, though?
I remember Bill Oddie saying on telly that you used to see seagulls inland, which meant that there were in a storm at sea. But now, of course, they've now adapted to living with us. I mean, certain animals do adapt well to our habits, and they are one of them.
I think it's one of the things that really characterises the cities. We've got seagulls around most of the time squawking. Now, one of the other things is that there are, I think it's something like a £2,000 fine for feeding seagulls and pigeons. Is that realistic? And then I wonder if anyone's actually been hauled through the courts.
It would be nice if people, if the council did fine, they threaten to fine and they put up notices, but they never seem to actually do anything about it. And perhaps a few, it's not so much the seagulls that they feed as the pigeons, because those can be a real menace, and people seem to want to feed them most unsuitable things right through the summer when they should be foraging for themselves.
Okay, we'll leave the seagulls for the time being, and my own personal opinion is good luck to them if they can get a bit of extra food because the bins are out. I think they've got quite a nice attitude to life, seagulls. I like them. Anyway, right, finally, Sir John Rose, and this is looking at another, essentially a local story. There's a chairman of Rolls-Royce. He's attacked Gordon Brown's new Labour business secretary, Peter Mandelson, saying that Mandelson is neglecting manufacturing in Britain, and that was, would you believe, after Mandelson announced that Rolls-Royce will be getting £45 million in government aid to help them set up four new factories. Now, instead of congratulating Mr. Mandelson and patting him on the back, he said, well, actually, you're not doing anywhere near enough. So what are your thoughts on that? Maybe, Martin, you could start.
Well, I think over many years, we've not had, I mentioned industrial policy earlier, we've not had a serious industrial policy because the philosophy has been that we didn't need one and that somehow, on its own, the market would come up with the right mix of investments. I think that the mood is changing against that. This is a senior industrialist saying this, and no doubt if it was a Conservative minister, he would be saying the same thing. And I think we do need to think more seriously about where we want to go and how we're going to get there and have some kind of a plan to do it.
Okay. Leslie?
Well, I've only seen this article a couple of minutes ago, and I wasn't aware of the dressing down that Lord Mandelson got yesterday. I suppose, as a free marketeer, I would hope that Rolls-Royce would be able to manage on their own, but they do, their engines go in all sorts of things. I mean, it's not just luxury cars. In the present economic climate, which has been brought about by some of this government's actions, perhaps then in a case like that, they need to help them a little.
But surely most people would say that this economic crisis is a massive kind of global event. We can't really point the finger at Gordon Brown, much as Conservatives would like to, and say it's all his fault.
Well, he hasn't exactly helped, I think.
How about you then, Martin? What are your thoughts about whether Mr. Mandelson should get a dressing down for helping Rolls-Royce to the tune of $45 million? Well, he wasn't actually getting a dressing down for that, but I think, in a way, I admire Sir John Rose for taking the money and then saying, well, actually, you're not really doing enough.
Yeah, well, I think if you think about Rolls-Royce, a lot of what they do is actually produce military production, which is final government consumption, whichever way you look at it. It isn't just luxury cars. So even if in a free market, you'd still have the putting Rolls-Royce engines in military kit. But, I mean, we have an industrial policy by the back door through arms procurement. I mean, that's the way the United States has an industrial policy. Boeing subsidises a lot of what it does through military contracts. Now, we ought to put this out in the open. If we're going to have a policy of basically steering industry by putting subsidies in here and there, well, let's put that on the table and let's do that openly rather than through the back door. That's what I would say, and I think that's the way any government will have to operate.
But do you think that the Sir John Rose, the chief of Rolls Royce, is right? We are, and Peter Mandelson and the Labour government are neglecting manufacturing.
Yes, they did, because they carried on the same philosophy which had gone on before, which was that government were hands off and they didn't need to have a policy. I think that will be shown to be completely erroneous as time goes on. I mean, whatever the government is, having a policy on industry will become centre stage. And Conservative governments used to have an industrial policy. I remember it was Edward Heath who took Rolls-Royce into public ownership in the 70s as an alternative to letting it collapse. And of course, that was the right policy then, and it's possibly the right policy now.
What do you think, Leslie? Is it possible that, I mean, we just heard that a Conservative government kept Rolls-Royce afloat 30 years ago. Can you see a future Conservative government intervening in the same sort of way to help manufacturing?
I think it depends on what's being manufactured. In a case like Rolls-Royce, where their engines are very important and they're probably the best engines we could possibly have in all our military equipment, we need to continue. We need to help them in that respect, yes.
So only if it's military, not other civilian stuff?
No, it depends what it is. If it was pretty frocks and things, no, they shouldn't help. But if it's something that's vital to our country, then yes, I think perhaps if a company is to go under for want of some help, then if it's vital to this country, then perhaps they should do it.
Okay, so I did say finally, and I'm kind of contradicting myself here, because there's another couple of things that have been in the news this week which have been quite controversial. This whole thing of assisted suicide has been being talked about the last 3 or 4 days again. I mean, it seems to re-emerge every few months. Can I just have both of your moral view? Do you think this is something which, I mean, it seems almost that the only rights which are being pushed at the moment are things like the right to die. You know, it doesn't seem like other sorts of civil liberties are being pushed. Can I just have your view on the morality of this whole business of assisted suicide, Leslie?
It's a very difficult topic altogether. When people are very ill they do not have any quality of life and they want to die, then I think, yes, especially if it's going to involve a very, very painful and difficult death, then yes, I think perhaps they need to be helped, or certainly their relatives ought to be free from prosecution. One thing that does worry me, though, is whether perhaps people will be pressurised because a family wants to inherit their worldly goods, and it is a very difficult dilemma, that one.
So do you think people may, do you think that's enough to make us back off from this? The fact that there may be financial pressures and other pressures on people to sort of sign bits of paper saying, oh yes, my granny is costing too much, therefore it's time for her to go.
No, we certainly shouldn't be doing that. I think it's got to be something that there's got to be safeguards for the person that wants to die, and I know it's difficult for them, but I think the medical profession are in the best place to do that. But it shouldn't be down to one person's thoughts. There should be two or three people that agree that it is actually something that is for the good and for the benefit of the person that is so very, very ill, rather than any family pressures.
Because it is, of course, the Hippocratic Oath that all the doctors take. It's all about preserving life. It's not about hurrying people along towards the end, is it?
No. I mean, there are cases now where the doctors do help. Well, they don't do it deliberately, but they don't stop somebody. And they perhaps they get rather stronger medicines than they might do in some of their cases, but no, it's not something that they're supposed to do.
So is there conservative support for this generally in the party, or is it another one of those issues, a bit like Europe, which is a bit of both?
I think it's
you haven't made the mind up yet.
I have to say that I haven't heard a particular view on this one. I think it is very much a down to a personal view.
So the Conservatives
moment
are taking a step back and just letting Labour get on with whatever they want.
I'm not absolutely certain on if there is a party view on that. I'm only sort of saying my own view, really.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with virtually everything Leslie said there. I think people should. I mean, personally, I want to have the right to take my own life if I'm suffering or ill, and my partner died of cancer some years ago, and you know, in many respects, I would have been happy. I'd have been happier for her to have that choice. But there must be safeguards, because there's always the danger that it's going to be in somebody's interest for somebody to disappear, and you know, we must never let people die because they're inconvenient. That shouldn't be the case, and there must be very, very strong safeguards against that.
So are you satisfied that there are safeguards in the what's being discussed at the moment?
Well, I think at the moment what seems to be happening is that people are pushing and saying they want this. I mean, this has all come out because this woman has said, I want this clarified. Mm-hmm. And she's very bravely gone to court to try and establish what the rules are, even though she's actually dying. And I think that, you know, some people clearly want to be able to do this, and they're clearly compass mentis and they know what they want, and those people should be allowed to do what they want, in my view.
So how does this compare to the right, for example, for the police to detain you without charge? You know, that seems to be something which has been shoved out of the way, and now the right to die is more important.
Look, I mean, we're just using we're talking about the meaning of the English word right there, you know, the right not to be, I mean, that's all we're talking about. I mean, of course we need more rights than the right to die, but that's what we're talking about at this moment, isn't it?
Okay, and finally, this really is finally this time for this week's news. That is Sir Richard Dannett, who's a general and command of the army, apparently in Afghanistan, is retiring. And he's saying that the whole thing has been left in a pretty awful state. Martin, what are your thoughts on the latest situation in Afghanistan? We've heard that Operation Panther's Claw apparently has been successful and is now over.
Well, we had some people from Afghanistan speaking in Bristol last Monday in Barton Hill settlement. They were saying that they wanted Britain to withdraw their troops from Afghanistan and let the Afghans solve their own problems. We've been collecting signatures in the centre of Bristol to that effect, and in actual fact we've had great success with that. I think many people in Britain do question what the point of all this is, and especially with the deaths of these very young soldiers. Recently, we got a very strong response when we were collecting signatures from women of all ages, saying that they couldn't see the point and that they wanted an end to it.
But we're being told again and again, this is a terrorist training area, and that's why we're there, is to stop the terrorists training.
Well, you know, and I know, we've discussed the London bombings on this programme many times. Those chaps came from Leeds. I think if, you know, that's what we need is good police work to catch.
Well, the allegations
terrorists
were that they had also gone over to Pakistan, Afghanistan, a place like that to get training, and that is why the British Army is over there in Afghanistan.
Yes, but you'll find is that the presence of the British and the Americans in Afghanistan is actually making the politics in Pakistan extremely poisonous. Both Hamid Karzai and the Pakistani president have been saying, please, will you, you know, for example, stop doing airstrikes because it's actually alienating people and making the situation worse. I think in the end, countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan have to resolve their own problems. Outsiders can't do it, I mean, however well-meaning. And I'm not saying that there's an easy way, but we need to be thinking about where's the end of this, because do we really intend to stay in southern Afghanistan the way we stayed in Belfast for 35 years, taking 4 casualties a week? Because I don't think we are.
Well, yeah, but if we withdraw, surely there's going to be more terrorists getting trained, aren't there? And at least that's the theory.
Well, I mean, then you have to take steps to deal with that. We're not stopping terrorism by blasting villages to pieces and killing lots of innocent people. That is terrorism, certainly to the Afghans. I mean, Panther's Claw, they were talking about the army arrived in this valley last week to try and win the hearts and minds of the population, but they'd all run away. There was nobody there, so they just had to get back into their helicopters and go away again, and then the people came back. No doubt that's exactly how they treated the Russians.
Leslie, what are your thoughts on Afghanistan? Is this a noble cause, or is it starting to reach the end of the line?
Well, I don't think it's noble. There's no noble about it. It is a very difficult one, and I'm not a military expert, but it does worry me that it is so adjacent to a very unstable country with a nuclear weapon like Pakistan, and I think therefore that we've got to stay there for the time being and try and resolve the problems that there are there.
Okay, well, that'll do for the time being. And let's now move on to have a chat to you, Leslie, as a Bristol City Conservative councillor and some of the work that you're doing. Can the Conservatives on Bristol City Council really influence anything? Because the Liberal Democrats are now firmly in control, aren't they?
The Liberal Democrats, yes, they have the majority, so they don't need either party to do anything. But then they never really did, apart from the budget, because we work under a cabinet system, and whilst the opposition parties could hold up things for a little while by calling in a decision, they couldn't actually stop it. Because the cabinet, they might have to stop and think again. But if they decide they're going to go the way they want to go, they will go the way they want to go.
So, what are your thoughts on this whole sort of cabinet system? I think the idea is to have a small executive who are making most of the new policy decisions, isn't it? And then to have some scrutiny of that. Do you think it works?
Not really, no. But then I would say that, wouldn't I? Because it was something that was brought in by the Labour government when they first came in. But a lot of councillors now feel that they're not making a difference. Why are they there? Because at least when we had the old committee system, we were able to make some decisions. Now we can only scrutinise what the cabinet is doing.
So are you not really able as an ordinary councillor, to feed into policy then?
We can feed into policy, but they might not choose to listen.
Ah. Right, you're on the health committee. That's one of the most important committees in the city, clearly. And can you just tell us about the work of that, what that involves?
Well, up to this last year, until now, I suppose, we've scrutinised the things that the National Health Service were doing, rather than anything that the council was doing. But we, as from this coming this new year, we are also looking at the things for adult social services as well. So our committee is now Health and Adult Social Services, which does mean that we are scrutinising things that the council does as well on the old social services side.
Yeah, because we were hearing just about 3 weeks ago or so that it looks like another 3 elderly people's homes may be being closed in Bristol quite soon. Is that the sort of stuff that you have to look through, sift through and argue the case for them to stay open?
That has been a very big issue in the last 3 weeks, because we were told there is something called the Residential Futures, which is about the old people's homes, and the council wants to close most of its elderly people's homes and move over to very sheltered accommodation, which is accommodation in their own homes, but in complexes where there is nursing staff available.
Now, this sounds a little bit like the old care in the community, where people were moved out of mental hospitals and then they had health visitors coming to see them.
This is much more like the old sheltered accommodation that we've had for a long time, where we've had homes for older people, over 50 plus, I suppose, with a warden. But the council is currently reviewing that policy and to see whether they need quite as many of those older people's homes, because the latest thing is the very sheltered accommodation, which is very similar, but with nursing care. So the idea is to keep as many people as possible in their own homes. But we do need some homes, especially for dementia sufferers. So the council is looking to have 3 new homes for dementia sufferers, one in the east, one in the north, and one in the south. The one in the east is going ahead, but there's problems with identifying exactly where they're going to have homes in the north and in the south. They have produced an interim report where they wanted to close a home in Hartcliffe and move everybody out. A lot of people have already moved out. Then it would be renovated as the South Bristol home for dementia sufferers. We were unhappy. The opposition parties were unhappy with the decisions that they were making just to close that, because we felt that there had been insufficient thought given to the staff that work in these homes. We don't pay them an awful lot of money. Most of them are on modest salaries, and there was no proper moves planned for those people, except that they would probably move them to another home, which could be 2 or 3 bus rides different, so that would be very expensive and time consuming, especially late at night. So there was that. Another option for a dementia home in the north of Bristol was the Bengough House, which is owned by Bristol Municipal Charities. But the cabinet want to go ahead and close that. We don't feel either that sufficient thought has been given to that, and all the other options haven't been satisfactorily explored.
So it sounds to me that you think that this is hasn't been really enough discussion with the people who are actually involved, that is to say, obviously elderly people themselves, the relatives of those elderly people, and the staff that are working at these places, that the council as a whole hasn't really been talking to people enough about what their plans are, you know, for the future.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
I would say that no, they haven't. They haven't talked enough to people. They do need to do that more. I do accept and appreciate that it's very difficult for people when they don't know what's going to happen to them, because it's not fair on those people. But equally, we've got to make sure that what we do now, whatever decisions are made and whatever plans we put in place, are fit for now and fit for the future, and not just a cost-cutting exercise. And the report that was going to the cabinet should normally come to scrutiny first, to be scrutinised. Now, that report and its appendixes were 140 pages, and I was told at the beginning of last week that it would not. Oh, the week before last, I think, that it would not be available to the scrutiny committee, because it hadn't been to the cabinet's agenda briefing so it wasn't going to be available until the day of our meeting. You cannot table 140 pages and expect us to do an in-depth scrutiny of that piece of work. So I adjourned the meeting, because I'm chairman this year, until this last Monday, so that we could we have more time to discuss it.
That sounds a bit naughty, doesn't it? Plomping a 140-page document on your desk and then saying, right, decide now.
Yes, exactly. We had something to say about that. The Labour Party had something to say about it. The unions most certainly did. We did make our recommendations. Or at least, the committee made its recommendations on Monday, which were not supported by the opposition parties. But unfortunately, the Liberals have one more person on that committee than the other two parties. So the report went through as they wanted, and it went through Cabinet last night as they wanted. The only amendment we got them to agree to was to look at one or two more alternatives for North Bristol. There was one home in particular that they thought that they could build onto. But they're not looking at any of the other alternatives, and there are some.
Well, of course, the effect of this on people in those homes must be dreadful.
It is dreadful, yes. And we need to resolve this. It has to be resolved satisfactorily, and at the moment it's not being.
Well, it's maybe when we have one of the Liberals in here, we'll be chatting to them about that and see what they've got to say about it. Now, you're also on the Planning Committee, which is notoriously one of the most sort of powerful committees in the city, you know, making some pretty big decisions.
Well, it's controversial.
Can you tell us what sort of decisions you've been making over the last few weeks on the Planning Committee?
Well, there's actually three planning committees in Bristol. Bristol North, there is the central committee that are major applications, and then there is East and South, and I'm on East and South.
Okay. Do you ever see the developers in bed with the controlling people of the planning committee?
No, I don't.
Because this is one of the things that we often think is that there's a bit of lobbying going on from the developers. There must be a fantastic amount of lobbying going on.
The developers, obviously, will push their cause, but equally the people are very good at pushing theirs as well. The council has to weigh up all the decisions and make a balanced judgment on whether something is a good decision or not. I mean, the other thing that the officers have to weigh up, and so do the planning committees, is whether whether there are good grounds to turn something down.
Because this is one of the problems with planning, isn't it, Martin? Do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I mean, the planning law favours the developer. I mean, you've got to come up with a good reason to say that something can... As long as they can show that they're not contravening the regulations, you're not really empowered to stop them.
If they're not contravening the regulations, yes. But what is now much more prevalent is that developers are expected to consult with local people before they put their applications in. The council does consult a lot of both internal and external people. The civic society is asked, local conservation groups are asked, obviously traffic have to have their view, design have another view. Any department or person that could be affected by those plans are consulted, so they all do have a view. I mean, I suppose the planning committees only see probably about 5% of all the applications. We don't see the extension to a house and things like that. The only things we normally see are major applications, and those things that are finally balanced, so we have to decide whether or not we think it would not cause a harm.
Okay. I know one of your particular interests at the moment is this new park and ride scheme. I mean, transport generally in the city is thought to be pretty bad, with First Bus amongst one of the most complained about bus companies in the country, and obviously pretty much a monopoly, which is totally against what the whole privatisation thing was about originally. Anyway, what's you were telling me earlier on about a park and ride scheme, which the council looks as if they're trying to push through, that you think is completely the wrong idea?
Well, they're looking at a park and ride for the M32, and they're looking to have it on some Grade A agricultural land, the best agricultural land in the city, which is the Stapleton allotments. And obviously there's very big lobby, because the air pollution in that area is not good anyway, because of the closeness of the motorway. For a park and ride there is also in a totally unsuitable place. It should be further out where the head of traffic starts. But Bristol are being rather weak, I think, in this respect. Rather than consult and cajole, if you like, with another authority, they're just taking the easy option. Let's have it within Bristol. Having said that, I think at the moment the plans are not being pursued with the same with the vigour that they were at one stage because of the whole transport plan
so
for
you
the
think
city.
Maybe you've helped. You've twisted their arm behind
no,
their back
I don't
a little
think
bit.
So
or not?
I think it. I think it'll come back, but I don't think it's quite so immediate as was one time thought.
Okay. Finally, if you could fix just one thing at the council, what would that be? That's a bit of a difficult question to spring on you. Yes.
Right, I think the the council need to if they have agreements, and for instance, I'm thinking on my feet at the tenancy agreements. Those agreements do say what you can and cannot do. The council have got those agreements in place, but they don't insist on a lot of those points, and it's making life very, very difficult for certain sections of the tenants.
Okay, so you've heard that. Stick to your agreements, Bristol City Council. Well, it's coming up to 6 o'clock, and that's all we have time for on Friday Drive Time this week. Join us at 5 on Friday every week here on BCFM, where we'll be reviewing the week's news and picking apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you have news you want discussed, questions about tonight's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you another relaxing and enjoyable weekend.